from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, author, professor, social critic, and advisor to the European Union, Jeremy Rifkin, will join us in studio for the hour. We'll talk with him about what he calls the Third Industrial Revolution and his belief that our future as a civilization relies on our ability to function empathically and to bring about global convergence of new energy revolutions with new revolutions in communication. He'll join us for that wide-ranging conversation, and it will include your emails, calls, and postings after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Jeremy Rifkin is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends, and for the past decade he's served as advisor to the European Union and to a number of European heads of state, including French President Nicolas Sarkozy and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He's also a senior lecturer at Wharton School's Executive Education Program at the University of Pennsylvania and author of many books, including The Hydrogen Economy, The European Dream, The End of Work, The Age of Access, The Biotech Century, and most recently, Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World of Crisis. And he's a man who at one time, Time magazine said, is the most hated man in science, but the New York Times said is one of our biggest thinkers and a social and ethical prophet. And welcome back to Forum. Good to see you.
Michael, it's good to be with you again.
Well, this book, it takes us really to the precipice here. It says we're at a key moment. Let's begin there. We need empathy. We need global consciousness. We need to sort of shift our sensibilities. And you're talking about the necessity of that.
Yes. You know, I think we may be at a seminal turning point in our history as a species. Michael, we had two events in the last 18 months, which I think actually signaled the end game for the great industrial age, which lasted over the last two centuries. Back in July 2008, you remember oil hit $147 a barrel on world markets. Prices soared, inflation roared, and basic items from food in the grocery store to gasoline became prohibitively expensive. And there were food riots in 30 countries. Purchasing power plummeted when oil hit $147 a barrel, and the entire economic engine of globalization literally shut off in July of 2008. That was the economic meltdown. That was the earthquake. The collapse of the financial market 60 days later, that was the aftershock. But our world leaders haven't come to grips with the fact that the Second Industrial Revolution is really on life support. Those energies have really sunsetted. And then if you fast forward to December 2009, Copenhagen. So our world leaders come together to deal with the entropy bill for the industrial age, the spent CO2 from two centuries of industrial way of life. They couldn't cut a deal. It completely collapsed. It just broke down, despite the fact that our scientists say this may be the most important and threatening event in the history of our species, climate change. So the question that kind of leads into the book is, why are our world leaders, why were they completely unable to anticipate or respond to the meltdown, the end game of the Second Industrial Revolution in July of 2008? And why were they unable to cut a deal on climate change, knowing that it's imperiling our species and our fellow creatures? And my suspicion is it goes deeper than just coming up with new regulations for a global market or carbon reduction targets. I think the real fault lies in the fact that our world leaders are using 18th century ideas about human nature and the human journey that we borrowed from the Enlightenment at the beginning of the market economy and nation era to address 21st century biosphere problems, and it is a complete and utter disconnect.
Yeah, John Locke and Adam Smith don't necessarily come off, well, they come off, I guess, from your judgment as maybe part of a metamorphosis that we're moving forward to, or you hope we're moving forward to, because you talk about empathic trends and a lot of biological and cognitive science, which is leading us to understand that maybe we have more neuron empathy, neurons for empathy and all that. So how do you teach empathy? How do you get nations, for example, who want to equal the playing field and say, you've been using this carbon all the time, now we want to use the carbon, to be more empathic?
Well, it's difficult. I think the first thing is we are so absolutely inundated with this old idea from the Enlightenment that it's hard for us to break open the door. I mean, if we are, as the Enlightenment philosophers say we were, that our human nature is we're born as detached, rational, calculating autonomous agents.
And material.
We pursue our material self-interest. We're utilitarian. We're pleasure-seeking to the core. If that actually is our human nature, then we're likely doomed, because I actually don't see any way that we could come together, 6.8 billion people, and create a global economy that's sustainable and address climate change and steward the Earth if that's actually what our nature is. And as you suggest, what we're beginning to see, and I'm sure you've done some shows on it, we're seeing some interesting breakthroughs in the sciences, in evolutionary biology, in neurocognitive science, in child development, which is forcing us to actually rethink these age-old shibboleths about human nature. And the breakthroughs are we're beginning to discover Homo empathicus. We're starting to see in biology that primates, at least some primates and all humans, are actually hotwired. We're biologically predisposed to feel empathy. It's part of our social makeup. That is to feel the other, their experiences, their pain, their sorrow, their sense of rejection, pleasure, whatever, to actually feel another's experience as if we were feeling it ourselves. And this has tremendous implications, because if actually our core nature is Homo empathicus, not Homo sapien, and we're born to be social and to seek belonging and intimacy and empathy, we'd have to change our parenting styles, our educational models, our business models. And it might give us some hope that we could actually take this empathic distress that's built into our biology and maybe think about, can we project that so we could become empathic as a species with the biosphere we live in? If we could get there, and I think it's a daunting challenge, then we could begin to live as a species sustainably on the planet. If we can't imagine the ability to become empathic on a human level across the species, I just don't see how we'll make it as a species on this earth.
Now, this is what you called moving from geopolitics to biosphere politics and the third industrial revolution. Now, you say that we are on the precipice of making this decision. You've been sort of taking a task, though, on the one hand, because 40% of the human race, you point out, have incomes of, $2 a day or less. And I don't know the exact phrasing, but you say they have little emotional reserves. And so some have said, well, you know, are you saying, in effect, that we, the West, have a corner on empathy or something along those lines?
No. I think the interesting question that I raise in this book is how – we know consciousness changes over history. The way our brain is wired today in the 21st century is not the same way that a medieval serf thought in the 10th century or some forager hunter 30,000 years ago. So the question is, what is the mechanism or the process in history upon which consciousness changes and empathy expands, if it does? And when I looked at it, what it seems to me is the great changes of consciousness occur in history when two things happen. First, we change the way we organize energy on the planet, and we've done that on frequent occasions. And second, we change the way we communicate to organize these new energy revolutions. When communication energy revolutions actually converge, they change consciousness and expand empathy. I'll give you an example. We all studied anthropology. We read about the Sumerians in Mesopotamia. They were the first to create high-end hydraulic agriculture, and the stored grain became the primary energy. But it was complicated because they had to build canals and irrigation ditches and urban granaries and mass road systems. So they needed a communication revolution to manage it, and they invented writing, cuneiform. And everywhere you see these hydraulic civilizations in the Middle East, India, China, independently, people come up with writing to organize this agricultural energy regime. In the 19th century, we had print communication come together with coal, steam, and rail to become the communication tool for that energy regime. We couldn't have organized the first industrial revolution with codecs. And in the 20th century, first-generation electricity communication became the vehicle to manage oil, the internal combustion engine, and the suburban rollout. What's interesting, though, about these convergences of communication and energy is the new communication revolutions not only organize the new energy regimes, they change consciousness. If you go back to a forager-hunter society, oral culture, they changed empathy. Empathy there only extended to blood ties because oral culture didn't allow you to go beyond shouting distance. So you empathize with your blood relations, your extended kin. When you go to these great hydraulic agricultural civilizations, we went to theological ways of thinking. The great religions formed at that time. And empathy extended from blood ties to associational ties. Jews started to empathize with Jews, Muslims with Muslims, Christians with Christians. When you get to the 19th century, the ideological age spawned by the first industrial revolution, empathy began to extend to nation states. So Americans started to see fellow Americans as their extended families, and Germans started to see Germans as their extended family, and empathy again stretched. So the question that I raise in the book is, if we started with empathy that was just blood-related, blood ties, we broaden it to religious affiliations, then to national identification, is it a big stretch to think we could now move the boundary to biosphere? Because our economy is becoming global, the biosphere is in jeopardy. Could we find new ways to think about education, business, and governance that would extend consciousness and empathy to the entire planet?
Well, we know, of course, that within families and within nations, there's great divisiveness. We also know that if there's a trajectory moving forward where empathy is concerned, we've got all the horrors of the world that face us. We've got Darfur going on. We've had Rwanda. We have the Congo. I mean, so it goes.
There's constant blowbacks. History is not an even path. And as we develop these new, more complex civilizations, there are moments of implosion. There are long periods of time where we actually go back and retrogress. But every time we mention Darfur, we should say also, look at Haiti. Here's a natural disaster, for example, that hit. And within hours, the entire human race responded empathically. Had we been, as the Enlightenment philosopher said, simply utilitarian, rational, detached, calculating, pleasure-seeking, libido-driven, then I doubt whether we would have had a human response on that scale. So I think what we need to ask is, what is history? You know, our historians actually chronicle the pathological side of history because it's newsworthy. It's why
James Joyce said it best. History is a nightmare from which I'm trying to escape.
Well, sure. And exactly right. He's right on target because the reason they chronicle the pathological parts of history is that they are not ordinary. So they get our attention. They're newsworthy. They become part of history. Wars, Holocaust, devastation. George Friedrich Hegel, the great German philosopher, said there's another history. He said happiness are the blank pages of history because when people are happy and harmonious, it isn't something the historians chronicle. But in this book, and granted it's a long book, I go back and look at another part of history, the empathic evolution of history as consciousness has changed. And although there's been blowbacks, we certainly are moving further and further toward empathizing as a human family. The problem is we have a paradox. And the paradox is the same civilizations that create more complex living arrangements, these new energy regimes and communication regimes, they create more complex civilizations. They bring more people together. They stretch the central nervous system of the human race and create more empathy, but they use up more energy.
So this is what you call the paradox of empathy and entropy.
It's a big paradox in history. Today, we live in this very interconnected, interdependent global economy. And certainly a younger generation is glimpsing biosphere consciousness. They're able to actually identify to their fellow human beings and their fellow creatures. But the same civilization is taking us to a depletion of our energy, massive climate change, and potentially our own extinction. So it's kind of bittersweet. We might be actually reaching the summit of our ability to actually think as Homo empathicus on a species level right at the time that the same forces are taking us down.
Maybe too late.
Maybe too late.
Talking to Jeremy Rifkin, his new book is The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World of Crisis. And you talk about four pillars here. Let's talk about those because they really are the centerpiece of what you have designed here. And really, talking about designs, in fact, sort of got into an architectural role for top government officials and CEOs who have signed on to your plan through the European Union, the European Union being maybe a paradigm for what you think could happen across continents. So let's talk about these four pillars. I mean, you've got first of all, obviously different kinds of technologies, non-fossil fuel and moving in that direction, not relying upon fossil fuel, but also buildings as power plants. And this is a kind of notion, microgeneration notion that maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with. I want to get to that specifically, but also hydrogen, which we talked about with you. Let's talk about the microgeneration first, though, because that's a really important concept. And on scale, it almost boggles the mind in terms of trying
It's extraordinary. What we see in the EU, I've been privileged to be with the EU over the last 10 years and was honored to do their third industrial revolution, third sustainability plan. It was endorsed by the parliament in 2007, and we're rolling it out across the 27 member states. We see another convergence of communication and energy in history. A new convergence. We see the internet revolution, this distributed ICT revolution, now coming together and converging with a new energy regime, distributed energy. And when distributed information communication technologies start to organize distributed renewable energies, we have a very powerful third industrial revolution, which we think can move consciousness and distribute it across the planet. So we actually began to develop empathy on a global scale. There are four pillars to this third industrial revolution that are being rolled out simultaneously in various regions of Europe. Pillar one, the EU is committed to 20% renewable energy by 2020. That's a third of the electricity of Europe. Done deal, way ahead of every other country. Pillar two, we see buildings as the new power plants, and that is converting every single building in the European Union, 500 million people, 27 states, from the Irish Sea to Russia, every home, office, factory, shopping mall, every building converted to a partial power plant that can then collect the distributed renewable energy around the buildings, the sun, the wind, the heat under the ground, et cetera.
Boy, is that ambitious.
It's ambitious, and it's starting. Pillar three, we talked about hydrogen back in 2002, yeah. Michael. Pillar three is the storage technology. You know, the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing, so you have to store it. So hydrogen is the way to store these energies. When the sun is shining on your roof, you get a little electricity. If you don't need some of it, you electrolyze water, hydrogen comes out, you store it, and when you need it, you convert it back to electricity. The EU has committed 8 billion euros this year to a rollout of storage. Then pillar four, this is where the communication revolution converges with energy revolution to give us perhaps a new form of distributed consciousness. We use the same exact technologies that created the internet, identical. We take the power grid of Europe and we turn it to an intergrid that acts exactly like the internet. So that when millions and millions of buildings are producing just a little bit of their own energy on site, distributed renewables, stored in hydrogen, like you store digital with media, and then peer-to-peer share it across an intergrid across the whole continent of Europe, in energy spaces that are just like the social spaces on the internet.
Actually, we've got intergrid now in Southern California. We've got it in Texas. We've got it in Colorado.
It's starting, but that's not a distributed grid yet. It's a smart grid. The question is whether you use the grid for distributed power, what we call in Europe distributed capitalism or power to the people, or whether you use the grid to keep centralized power. Our belief is that once we go to distributed communication, organizing distributed energy, third industrial revolution, it means that every family and business takes responsibility for their small swath of the biosphere by collecting the renewable distributed energy on site, then sharing it across continental land masses. That would give us the idea of biosphere awareness, that we go from geopolitics to biosphere politics because we do think global and act local, and we integrate a collaborative energy venture across entire continents.
This literally changes consciousness. I mean, that's the hope, and that's what you're trying to foment.
That's the hope. And I should say, empathy, you know, is the opposite of utopianism. People say, well, isn't this sound utopian? We can't even pass a healthcare bill, and you're talking about biosphere awareness. But
you don't even have to talk utopia. Talk about political will. Really.
We don't have the political will, but that's because we're living off ideas that actually thwart our real nature. If you have a set of governing institutions and business models and school models that promulgate the idea that we're self-interested, utilitarian, pleasure-seeking, autonomous agents, then that's the kind of world that we create in the institutions we have. So I think we have to rethink the human narrative. If our scientists are right and we are homo empathicus, that we are wired for that, and if that is thwarted by our society, then the secondary drives come in, the narcissism, the aggression, and the violence. We got to get back to our core nature.
Well, let me get you back to healthcare, because one could say this is a failure of political will. One could also say it's a failure of empathy, because the President of the United States, Barack Obama, said, this is a moral issue. We need to feel for all these people who don't have health care, and we need to do something about it.
Well, that's why we have to have a global discussion. I really believe that, you know, at the beginning of the modern market economy and nation-state era, there was a great philosophical discussion. It all happened in less than 30 years. That was the Enlightenment philosophers, John Locke, Adam Smith, René Descartes, Condorcet, and they took on the church's worldview. The church said that human nature is depraved, we're born in sin, and salvation waits in the next world. The philosophers of the Enlightenment said, no, you're born to seek your own utilitarian interest. I think we have to have a new global discussion at the dawn of a global economy and a biosphere era on rethinking human nature. And if our real core nature is homo empathicus, we've got a lot of work to do to change all of our institutions, from schooling to governance. Michael, you remember after the Iran elections, this gets to this whole question of politics and will, all right? After the Iran elections, those flawed elections, you remember the young college students protested in the streets. It got violent. The government started to shoot. One young woman, a college pre-med student, was gunned down on the streets. And you remember someone had a cell phone video and viewing that as she died. Within an hour on Twitter and YouTube across the world, an entire generation right there all over the world empathizing with those students in solidarity on those streets. So even though there's all of these bad things in the world, we are now connecting the central nervous system to the human race, for sure.
But they're still tyranny in Iran. And as you spoke about that, I thought, of course, about the young man on top of the tank in Tiananmen Square before things moved as quickly as they do today. And there's still tyranny in China.
There is. And so this gets to the question about what empathy really is. There's no empathy in paradise. There's no empathy in utopias because there's no mortality. Empathy is actually opposite of a utopian vision. It's based on the idea that each of us, as we develop our selfhood, we begin to understand that we have a one and only life, that we're fragile and vulnerable, that we're going to live and die, that we have a personal history. And as we become aware of that, then we become aware of other people's fragility, their one and only life, and how difficult it is to be alive. Whether you're a human or a fox in the woods, it's damn difficult to be alive. So empathy is a recognition of our life and death and a celebration of our life. When I empathize with someone, I feel their struggle to flourish and be, to have their moment. And my compassion is I'm rooting for them. So empathy is all about struggle and imperfections and flaws and solidarity. And that's a very, very human emotion. If we can find a way to express it in our institutional way of life, our civil society, our schools, our business models, maybe we have a shot at saving our species and continuing this little experiment called Homo empathicus on the planet.
When you're talking about empathy, the way you describe it almost makes me think of President Clinton, former President Clinton, saying, I feel your pain. But it's more than that. I mean, because in the book, you really are talking about finding happiness.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you just raised this a few minutes ago, you said, look, here's the bottom line. We've got half the human race living beyond our means, all of us, and we have a huge carbon footprint. We got the other half of the human race living on $2 a day or less, small carbon footprint, but barely able to survive.
And wanting a bigger carbon footprint.
Absolutely. And that's the struggle. So how does empathy fit into this? The interesting thing is these new studies on happiness are quite illustrative. You know, John Locke at the beginning of the Enlightenment said, if the more you acquire property, the happier you are. All right? So that's been the modus operandi. But these new studies on happiness are quite intriguing. They're showing that if you're really poor, of course, you're not happy because you're barely able to survive. As you get more wealth, you become happier. When you reach the threshold of comfort, where the basics are met, that's the threshold. After that, the wealthier you get, the more unhappy you are. So we have to find a way so half the human race that's living too high up on the carbon deposits and destroying the planet can live more sustainably while the bottom half moves to the threshold.
It's called distributive capitalism.
Well, it is, but also I'm going to step on some toes here. I think it's we got to change the dream. The American dream does not work. The American dream is based on the old Enlightenment ideas that everyone's a self-interested, autonomous agent and should be able to pursue their individual opportunity. You can't have 6.8 billion cowboys and create species-wide empathic identity. We need to move to a quality of life dream that's sustainable so that the human race can come together.
As Biff Loman says in Death of a Salesman, kill that dream, huh? Let me bring our listeners into this. In fact, you're welcome to join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and please feel free to join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join the conversation, 866-733-6786, or send an email, forum@kqed.org. And you can also leave your questions and comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, Talking with Jeremy Rifkin, always a provocative thinker. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Jeremy Rifkin, who is the best-selling author of The European Dream and has a new book out called The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, well-known economist and social and radical thinker in many ways. You don't mind that label, do you?
Not at all.
I mean, when you start talking about things like distributive capitalism, I guess you get some people's hackles up, don't you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I chair something called the Global CEO Business Roundtable. It's 125 CEOs of leading European American companies. And we're now working in Europe, and we just started in America, to lay down master plans to move us to a post-carbon distributed capitalism era. And so our companies are the major renewable energy companies, of course, the major construction companies, the major real estate companies, IT companies, logistics companies. The energy companies aren't with us, I should say. They're not too happy with this. But we really are ready to lay down this distributed revolution. We brought together the world's cooperatives with the world's global corporations, because what we want to do is set up energy cooperatives in every region so that people control their own energy and then are able to then peer-to-peer connect it in energy spaces like social spaces on the internet. My hope is that what we're doing in Europe will blow back to America. I'm not sanguine. I'm not naive. I think it's an uphill climb here. But I think we have a younger generation, especially on the West Coast from Vancouver to L.A., that their sensibilities are much more in tune with continental Europeans, for sure. Absolutely.
Well, there was talk, as I'm sure you're aware, for quite some time that maybe North America, that is Canada, U.S., and Mexico, would form something like the European Union, which would make it a lot easier in terms of intergrid and the sorts of things you're talking about here. But it hasn't. There hasn't been much action on that.
There hasn't been much action because the U.S. is such an elephant in the room. In the EU, nobody can control the game, and it's public financing of elections. So it really is a network politics. And I'd remind your listeners, when people talk about the G2, the U.S. and China, reality check. The 27 member states of the EU's GDP exceeds the GDP of our 50 states. And if you put the U.S. and China together, it's almost matched by the total wealth of the European Union. It's just the EU is not a military power. It's an economic power. But, you know, Michael, I think consciousness is changing in very, very demonstrative ways. You remember when the Apollo spaceship took its last trip across the dark side of the moon. Then when they hit the bright side, the sun shining on the Earth, they took some photographs. And we put those photographs of the Earth on our walls, remember? These big color photographs of the Earth. That was a change in consciousness. Today, an entire generation, the millennial generation, they do this every day with Google Maps. I'm going over to Google right from this the show today. They, with a Google map, you go from outer space, you shoot right down to a house or a building 10,000 miles away, and you can look in the window. So this out-of-body experience is part of this temporal spatial orientation. As we move to distributed communications, which connect the central nervous system to the human race, and distributed energies, which connect us to the energy of the planet, it does give us the opportunity of distributed consciousness, of actually beginning to think as Homo empathicus. Then the bigger question, how do we actually prepare an empathic civilization? What I'd like to get my hands on is a school system. This school system around the world reflects 18th century ideas about utilitarian self-interest. Each individual is an autonomous agent in the classroom. Knowledge is power. You don't share it. That's cheating. Each person is trying to become a productive, competitive agent in the market. No wonder we're having problems. What we want to do, I think, in our school systems is we want to set up collaborative learning environments. We want knowledge to be interdisciplinary and distributed. We should take service learning, you know, where you serve in the community, and ratchet it up to pedagogy. So our young people begin to think the classroom is the community where they engage empathically with others and actually create relationships that are designed to express our core values. That would be a revolution worthy of America, a new revolution in our educational system. We also ought to have to revolutionize our business models so the business models reflect our core nature.
I got to read you this first email out of the chute. We do have our thinkers out there in our audience, as is always exemplified to me by questions that come across like this. This is from a listener in Los Altos. It says, it seems at first blush that any human endeavor would be improved with more empathy, except perhaps boxing and hockey. It also seems plausible that the brain physiological basis empathy might someday be well enough understood that it could be induced technologically. Does your guest think it would be moral to induce empathy in others, possibly without their consent? I've tried this weaponized empathy idea out on a few friends, and the best objection I heard was that empathy is morally neutral, usable just as easily to manipulate others as it is to achieve the golden rule. I'd like to hear whether your guest thinks there's a dark side to empathy.
Actually, I don't, in terms of how I've looked at empathy in the book. There are those who believe empathy is just a cognitive reading of another so that one can get into another's thoughts and feelings. And then, of course, use it for whatever ends one has in mind.
But it's beyond that. It's more commiseration, really.
Yeah, that's why empathy really does not have a dark side, because to truly empathize, I have to feel that another's experience, their plight, their condition, their struggle, their flourish to be, that I can feel it because I feel the same existential sense in myself, my struggle to be. And there is no dark side to that, because it's based on on solidarity with each other's vulnerabilities, our fragilities, our shortcomings, and each of us desiring to actually flourish and be in this world. It extends to humans, and we can extend it to our fellow creatures, and we do it in 100 different ways every day.
But it gets back to the question I asked earlier. Can you teach empathy? And some think, of course you can. You know, you say get into the schools and you can foster it, you can inculcate, but at the same time, there's almost a kind of mechanism that's involved. Some people seem to have it and some don't.
Well, I'll give you an example. In the empathic civilization, I take a long look through history at parenting behavior and marriages and parenting styles that have changed. It changes dramatically. I'll give you an example. 100 years ago, if your little child took someone else's little child's toy, your little toddler, took it away and the other little child started crying, what would mom and dad do to the child? They'd whack him. Or they'd say bad and they'd shame the child. All right? Shaming cultures do not promulgate empathy because they squelch the human spirit. If you shame a baby and say you're unworthy, you don't measure up, the aggression and violence comes out with a vengeance. Now,
boy, excuse me, I've got to put a plug in here for a movie I just saw last night called White Ribbon. Do you know about this movie? I mean, it's all about Germany before First World War and about how authoritarian and how much abuse there was.
Absolutely.
And all of that. It was made by a German filmmaker, and what he's really trying to show is this is a culture full of shame. And
absolutely.
And it was able to breed, essentially, Nazism.
Absolutely. And you know, in my book, if you look at the dedication of the book, I dedicate the book to my wife, and I dedicate the book to January 27th, 1945. That was the 12 hours after my twin sister and I were born. That's when Auschwitz and Birkenau was liberated. And the dedication is to all those who survived, all those who perished, and those yet to come. Because I do think that the parenting style was quite important, the Prussian parenting style, to the aggressive, violent behavior in that society. But what does a parent do today to show you how empathy evolves? Remember I said in history we have various forms of consciousness that go with energy communication revolutions. Hunter-gatherer societies, their consciousness is mythological. You go to the great religious theological societies, the hydraulic agricultural civilization, all based on the great religions. When you go to the 19th century, ideological consciousness, first industrial revolution. 20th century, psychological consciousness. The electricity communication revolution ushered in psychological ways of thinking. So today, we think differently than our grandparents. If grandma were, say, at a Thanksgiving dinner and breaks a glass, passive-aggressive behavior, and you say to grandma, wait a minute, you broke that glass, you're acting out, there's some transference here, is there something about your childhood that you just reminisced about? Grandma doesn't have a clue. Today, we think therapeutically. So when a mother or father is with a little toddler today, and that toddler takes another toddler's toy, and the other toddler starts to cry, mom and dad takes their kid aside and say, Johnny, look at Billy crying. How would you feel if Billy did that to you? Now go over to Billy. So then the little toddler goes over and sees Billy's crying, and then the toddler starts crying, and the parent says, well, perhaps give him a toy or kiss him. They're teaching him guilt, but what they're saying to that child is not shame. We trust your humanity if we can, and the parent's the first analyst, the first therapist. We trust your humanity. If we can put you in the right script here, we can help you understand how to channel your biological drive for empathic distress so you understand through this story how to mature empathy. That's an evolution in empathy. You didn't have that 200 years ago. You had corporal punishment.
Yeah, there's a scene in this film, in fact, that I just alluded to, The White Ribbon, where these kids are making whistles out of twigs, and one makes a whistle. The son of the baron in the movie, in fact, makes a whistle that's working very well, and the other kid is so angry because he's not making a whistle like that. He throws him in the water and really almost tries to drown him, but let me get our callers in here and get them involved, and we'll go first to Lisa. Good morning.
Thank you. I love your message, and I have a question. I think there's a lot of people already whose consciousness is quite empathic and quite involved, but I feel like we're often thwarted by powerful economic interests, insurance companies in the healthcare fight, oil companies fighting against climate targets. You mentioned changing our institutions, our political institutions, our corporations. How do we do that?
I think that we begin to talk with each other and we create a global conversation. Human beings, we live by narrative. We live by storytelling. We're the only creature, all creatures communicate, and mammals are social, and many have crude cultures, and they even have empathic response. We're the only ones that use language to tell stories. We live
by. Know about dolphins entirely.
Well, we don't know. They may, but we live by our stories, and we've got a bad story out there. It doesn't fit the 21st century. Our story about being self-interested, libido-driven, pleasure-seeking utilitarians fit the frontier period of colonization. in the market era, nation-state era. But now we've got 6.8 billion people that have to live together and try to create a sustainable economy and deal with climate change. I think we need a new conversation. What heartens me is the scientists are actually discovering what we probably should have already known, that we are wired for this empathic distress. I think we need that discussion in every form. I think we need it in the family. We need it in our schools. We need it in our business institutions. We need it in our civil society groups. And if we can have a robust global discussion on how we move from geopolitics to biosphere politics, how we actually explore our core nature as homo empathicus, then we're going to be able to prepare an empathic civilization. Right now, we can't, because the whole way the government operates and business operates is based on these old ideas about human nature, and they become self-fulfilling. If we think we're nasty, brutish, and self-interested, we'll create institutions to reflect it, and then we become what we are, but we lose our core nature. Our core nature is to be social.
This is an intelligent level of conversation, though, and you think about, I think about some people who are so involved in, say, the tabloid culture and really almost like non-thinking organisms. I'm not being elitist here. I'm just talking, I think, reality, because we understand that there are people out there who are just pleasure-seeking and don't care about anything else.
Well, let's go to the deathbed test. This is, my wife says, the deathbed test for everybody, regardless of whether you're a thinking person or not. When people are on their deathbed, or when they're old and gray and looking back at life, no one looks back at life for the moments where they were able to pursue their material self-interest, become more autonomous, seek their pleasure, or find some utilitarian act to be engaged in. When you look back at a life on the deathbed, the photographs in one's memory are the empathic moments. They always are, where one is able to transcend and actually experience and feel another's existential plight and root for them and celebrate them, because that's when we transcend ourselves. We feel pretty super alive in those moments. Those are the photographs we etch in our memories. And I think so we know what our core nature is at the end of life. We now know that at the beginning of life, that's our core nature. The problem is we've got to fill in from birth to death and create an institutional environment that creates an empathic civilization. It's a tough thing. I'm going to say to everyone listening out there, I think the jury's out. I don't even know if we can do this. But I don't know if there's a plan B. If we can't begin to create an empathic civilization and think as a species and steward our fellow creatures, the listeners have to tell me, how do we save ourselves and how do we save this planet? I don't see it in the cards.
Dan just brings to my attention a New Yorker cartoon of an old man on his deathbed saying, I wish I had bought more crap. But let's get some more of your calls on, and we'll go to Carla. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have lots of thoughts based on what you're saying. I'll try to be really brief. The first one is about the symbolic nature of this, that it was, what you're talking about is the expansion of energy, we, you know, convert that, which can be converted to heat, and the expansion of human warmth. And the second point I want to make is about going back to one of the emails. I agree that what we're talking about here is the golden rule of doing unto others as one would have others do unto oneself. And, you know, these ideas go back to Confucius and are embedded in is the foundation of the teachings of Jesus. The church has made a real attempt to sort of spread this idea in the world. And that's really, I think, the foundation of what you're saying here, that if we don't love one another, we're not going to go anywhere. The church has failed in lots of respects that, you know, we don't need to go into. But those ideas, I think, and when you're talking about...
Excuse me, Carla, are we talking about love here or empathy? I don't know that the two are necessarily...
This is a matter of the heart. You can't be really, truly, and in fact, actually, thank you for saying that, because I don't think we get through this through language of thinking. It's a matter, we have to use language that has to do with morality, you know, ideas of morality. We actually, in this country, I think, don't have a problem of economics, but it's a moral imperative for corporations to step forward and bring jobs be more fair in terms of distribution of wealth.
Carla, let me get a response from Jeremy Rifkin.
Well, you know, in the book, there's a whole, one of the three sections of the book is the history of consciousness change and empathic evolution over history. It is true that empathy with big blowback periods, but empathy does kind of steadily move forward to larger domains because as new communication revolutions organize new energy regimes, they create more complex civilizations and they allow us to extend our central nervous system so that we can bring more people together, connect socially, and begin to socialize in a more intimate way.
But a lot of that connection is virtual. It's not like you and me facing each other. So it doesn't have the kind of intimacy potential that you want from an empathic connection.
But you know it does. Now, I'm going to go back to you because you're teaching a course this semester, you know, on theater in the 20th century. Take a look at the romance novels. I have a long section on the romantic period. The romance novels, of course, were virtual. But the ability to sit and reflect on protagonists in those novels and actually go into the inner their inner beings, because the romance novels and all the early novels were really about exploring the inner psyche of other people, their feelings, their plight, their condition, their existential sense of themselves.
Now, literature teaches empathy.
Absolutely.
I
and one can empathize and absolutely break down in tears reading a book. And one can do it in a movie. These are learning environments in which we learn to express ourselves. But I want to get back to the caller for a minute. Each of these shifts in empathy have a good side and a dark side in this sense. When empathy extends, there's always a border, and everyone over the border is the other. So in tribal blood ties, empathy is just your blood relations. Everyone else is a demon or a monster. When you get to the great religions, the golden rule was there. Empathy did extend to associational ties, but if you were not of that same religion, you were considered the other and perhaps, you know, an infidel or a heathen. When you get to the industrial era, and empathy extends to national identity, and you empathize with extended families, Americans with Americans, Germans with Germans, what's the alien other? Those who are not part of that family. We now have the opportunity to move to a species identity, biosphere awareness. I suspect the other at that point might be aliens from outer space, but certainly not within the planet.
Or as some of the animal protective people would say, the other becomes other species, other mammals, for example. In fact, Peter Singer and some of these philosophers are telling us we need to extend our empathy also to the world of animals, and we need to stop eating them and stop killing them.
And, you know, I completely agree. I spent a lot of time – I'm a vegetarian myself. My wife and I are animal rights activists, and in spirit, and I spend a lot of time on how empathy has developed with our fellow creatures, really from the beginning of the romantic period in the early 1800s to today. I think one of the most powerful movements in the world today is the young people who are becoming much more empathic to our fellow creatures. I'll give you an example that comes to mind to talk about global consciousness. When that little video was shot of the polar bear and her cub on that ice floe in the Arctic, and you knew they weren't going to make it, a whole generation of young people extended their empathy to that creature and by that projection to the rest of their fellow creatures. Unless people think this is so naive, check out the school systems around the U.S. What are our kids being taught? If you go into the schools today, this is all in the last 5 years, every day from kindergarten on, our young kids are taught that everything they do, every behavior they have every day, the food they eat, the clothes they wear, the car their family drives, the electricity they use, that their lifestyle intimately affects the well-being of someone else or some other creature somewhere else on the planet. That's the beginning of biosphere consciousness.
Like my mother telling me people are starving in Europe, it's the same kind of thing.
It is. Well, that's actually, you know, that is.
You're supposed to eat your food. That was guilt-inducing, too. But let me go to a few of our emails here. Bob writes, Rifkin says, we must rethink the narrative under which we are now operating. One reason we are stuck in the narrative is that we believe our narratives, which are really only mental constructions. Wouldn't it help us to find our empathic consciousness if we recognized and reminded ourselves that the narrative is not reality?
I think that's a good observation. But the narratives are – we do construct our narratives, but the narratives are our reality. They're the way that we actually try to get an understanding of who we are at a given time in history. And so our narratives – when I
– You know the line of Kurt Vonnegut's, you are who you pretend to be, so be very careful.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you and I were talking about this at the break, but I had a difficult time at first. This is a 5.5-year venture, this research, because when I look back at history, the historians don't chronicle the evolution of consciousness and the evolution of empathy. They chronicle the pathology, the power, the wars, the new technologies, the redress of grievances. I had to go back through the narratives. I had to go back and look at our history because our history has been given through our literature, from the great saga, starting with Gilgamesh, the first written...
Which is really the Noah story.
Absolutely. All the way to the Chivalric romances, and then modern novels, 20th century theater. And as we look through the narratives we've created, then we understand how evolution and empathy has developed much better than the historians, because they actually don't give any account of it at all.
Listeners writing in, Tim says, it's thoroughly appropriate and welcome for Mr. Rifkin to be empathizing empathy right now because people are caught in the mania, the fear that the only thing humans know how to do well these days is selfishness. But in the end, human nature encompasses both empathy and selfishness, and both can get out of balance. Empathy out of balance, for example, is codependence.
What? That's very interesting. Let me strike a political note, if I might. When political conservatives sometimes hear the word empathy, they hear collectivism.
Or even socialism, specifically.
Yes.
Yeah.
When liberal left people hear the word individualism, they hear the word selfish. The fact is, as I say in this book, self-development and individuality go hand in hand with empathy. As you trace the history of individuality and selfhood, differentiation of self, the more differentiated the self, the more one understands oneself and matures the self, the more one can then empathize with other selves and create solidarity. So actually, empathy is a way that brings together selfhood with a sense of our solidarity with each other, because we understand the fragility and the vulnerability of each of us, and we're rooting for each other to flourish.
That's a very Jungian notion, actually, in some ways. The individuation brings on more recognition.
And more integration.
The other and more integration, exactly. Listener writes, no discussion of human nature can be complete until it is recognized that the essence of that nature is the fear of death. All the other aspects of it that you enumerated are derivative from that fear. Unless and until we solve this mystery, we are doomed at least to a massive dieback, if not extinction.
Amen. One of the sub-themes in the empathic civilization is the fear of death. And, you know, for a long time, there's been a long debate between the age of faith versus the age of reason. What I'm suggesting here is that we're moving from the age of reason to the age of empathy. We will not leave the core values of the age of faith and reason behind. They become part of the new ensemble. But the problem with the age of faith and reason is not the core principles, but both of them take a skewed picture of mortality. They try to escape it and deny it. For the age of faith, you find eternal salvation in the next world. For the age of reason, you find some kind of mortality by a cornucopia on earth. Both of them eschew the body. The body is considered evil or depraved because it's mortal by the theologians. And the philosophers of the Enlightenment see the body as transient, unpredictable. The emotions
But it's still a vessel for potential pleasure and all that.
Well, that's right. But it's certainly they try to separate the mind from the body and the spirit from the body. The problem is when you try to disassociate the body in embodied existence, you sever empathy, because empathy is based on our mortality. It's based on our physicality. It's based on our attempt to flourish and to live and to be, even knowing that our time is limited. So when religion and the age of reason philosophers try to hide our mortality and escape into other worlds, whether it be paradise in heaven or a utopia on earth, what they did is they left behind what makes us human, and that is our mortality, our understanding and consciousness that we live and die, the preciousness of each life, that each moment in each life is a personal history that won't be repeated. That's the very basis of empathy.
I should mention we're going to be talking tomorrow with Jacob Needleman, who has written a book about God. What is God is the title. If we sound philosophical here, like suddenly forum is moving in that direction, and so be it. Right. Although, Jeremy Rifkin is, of course, an economist by training. Let me get Tom on here. Tom, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Okay.
My name's Tom Alas. I'm writing a film right now about trying to revisit the ideas of Adam Smith. And I like Jeremy Rifkin's emphasis on the findings of neuroscience and mankind's social nature, but I would really suggest that you revisit Adam Smith, in particular the theory of moral sentiments, where he's known as the father of classical economics, and one of my purposes is to try to rescue him from the bear hug of the right, because the theory of moral sentiments, which he saw as his crowning achievement, started from the principle of sympathy as the basis of universal morality. I like your ideas, but I don't agree with this whole cloth rejection of Enlightenment ideas. I feel that Smith has been misread, which is understandable because of the volume of his
writing. Tom, excuse me. We've got just about a minute and a half.
Well, let me say thanks for calling in on this. I do mention the moral sentiments, and I do spend some time on Adam Smith's other side. But I point out that for all intents and purposes, The Wealth of Nations became his signature, not moral sentiments. Yes, you're right. There was another side. Same with Hume and some of the other Enlightenment philosophers. But the bottom line is what we have really distilled from that period is the idea of our utilitarian side. Look at Charles Darwin. His later works, especially his works on emotions in animals, was an empathic approach to evolution. Not too many people have read it. Michael, I think in the final analysis here, my sense is, and this came out of my experience in Europe, I think we have a pretty good economic game plan for Europe, the Third Industrial Revolution, distributed energy and communication. I don't think there's a plan B, going back to the 20th century, sunsetting industries and energies. But the reason I wrote The Empathic Civilization is I don't think we're going to get to where we need to go, which is to save our species and our planet with just good economic plans or new technologies, unless we rethink the human story.
Well, the book is The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World of Crisis. Jeremy Rifkin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Another hour of forum coming up. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court decision last Thursday on campaign financing and corporate giving and the First Amendment. We hope you will join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this hour. We wouldn't be here without our listenership, and so we are appreciative of you being with us here. Also want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.